Hi, everyone. This is Drew. Hey, we've been providing authentic, in-depth interviews about spiritual stuff for over 15 years now. But there's a change a-coming. Now, if you've already heard this message, just skip ahead to the interview. But if it's the first time, will you do me a solid and hang with me for just a few minutes? You know, about 15 years ago when I moved back to Canada after being a pastor in Australia, I realized that there was no way in the world that I should be in any form of spiritual leadership for so many reasons. But I think the main reason was because I've always struggled with belief. Now look, I'm still incredibly curious about what gets people through the night, and more often than not, it ends up being someone's faith or spiritual beliefs. So I created a radio show that set out to interview cultural icons and religious leaders, celebrities, and, you know, everyday people about what they believe, but more importantly, why they believe. And along the way, my faith has gone from simply being a noun to a verb. And I've also discovered that doubt is actually more compatible with faith than certainty. In other words, I no longer feel guilty about my doubts. So thanks for tuning in as I interview all sorts of people about all sorts of faith. I hope their journeys, no matter what they believe, have had a profound impact on your journey, and that your faith has also become a verb. Because, in my opinion, being spiritually neutral, that's an oxymoron. By the way, thanks to Joy Radio for letting me broadcast all of this spiritual tension, because I think this tension is where real faith is cultivated, in between hope and doubt. Together, Joy Radio and my team have created Canada's most listened to spiritual talk show. Okay, that's all the kumbaya stuff. Now here's the ask. And I know, I'm the same. I'm rolling my eyes as well. It's kind of like when Wikipedia puts up that note asking for money every once in a while, or when your local publicly supported radio or TV station does one of those annoying fundraising campaigns. I completely ignore them as well. I guess my thinking is that an organization like Wikipedia probably makes enough money anyway. Or, worst case scenario, they'll find enough people to support them. But please, if you're a regular listener of the Drew Marshall Show, man, I kind of really need your help. The station I've been broadcasting on for over 15 years has never actually paid me to do the show. Instead, they've let me try to sell advertising. But that's been a little more of a challenge than I imagined, because religious advertisers sometimes feel that my show isn't religious enough, and quote-unquote normal advertisers sometimes feel like we're too religious. So it's been a long, crazy uphill battle over the last 15 years just trying to make a living, living in that tension. Trust me, I'm struggling to pay the bills just like you are. But as we start season 16 in September, we just found out something huge. Joy Radio will now be charging me for airtime. Now, surprisingly, this is standard practice for a lot of radio shows, especially on faith-based radio stations. But the bottom line is that there will now be an astounding 30% hike in costs for me. Ugh. Airtime's not cheap, and to be honest, finding even more advertisers to cover that 30%, it's kind of freaking me out a little bit. So, maybe you've been downloading our podcast and don't actually have to listen to the advertising that our radio audience listens to during each live four-hour show. And by the way, just so you know, any advertising we've actually been able to find has only ever covered about 70% of our annual costs. So the ask is this: would you consider going from being just a consumer of our show to becoming a patron? Would you mind throwing us a few bucks each month just to help us cover that 30% difference? Heck, you know what? If we can get enough patrons supporting the Drew Marshall Show, we could feasibly get to the point where we become completely listener-supported without the need of any advertising. Now that would be amazing. So, a patron. What? What is that? Well, a patron was the kind of person who allowed Shakespeare to create a product that also spoke of similar life tensions. Tensions that most people were living, but few were admitting to each other. A patron is someone who appreciates the product they're consuming so much that they're willing to throw a few bucks towards securing a future for that product. Now, just FYI, there are over 100,000 creators being supported by patrons through Patreon right now. So this is becoming the new way to say thank you to those who create the products we all consume online. Now, I fully understand the fact that I'm certainly no Shakespeare. I get that. But someone said to me recently that they would absolutely support our show monthly. Methinks there might be others. Yea, but maybe not. Let's findeth outeth. Yeah, I should never do that again. So here's the ask. Will you support the Drew Marshall Show $4 or $9 or $19 a month? By the way, that's American coin. So sorry to everyone listening from parts of the world whose currency is kind of struggling against the US dollar. But here's the other thing. If you cannot afford it, please, obviously, no worries. When I used to be a pastor, I would say, hey, when the offering plate goes around, if you can give, give. If you need some, take some. So just take our show for free, guilt-free, if you can't afford $4 a month, please. Because the conversations we're having in the Drew Marshall Show, I honestly feel need to be heard no matter what. Look, my dream is to have the most brutally authentic spiritual talk show in the world. And here's why that's important to me. Because I really believe that a key ingredient to spiritual growth is authenticity. And the tension of a brutally authentic spiritual talk show makes some people feel uncomfortable. But as far as I'm concerned, faith is messy and it can be brutal. But instead of looking the other way, our show dares to stare back into this beautiful mess called faith. So thanks for your support as we continue to live in the tension between belief and doubt, and while trying not to take ourselves too seriously along the way. Hopefully you'll laugh, sometimes you'll cringe, but no matter what, please know that what I care about most is brutally authentic spirituality. Now, go drink the Kool-Aid, will ya?
Cult reference!
And become a patron of The Drew Marshall Show. Thanks for listening.
The earth was being born with the loveliest of them all.
Was it Enneagram 4?
It was green alligators and long-necked geese. Some Humpty Bacchamas and some chimpanzees. Some cats and rats and elephants, but sure as you're born, the loveliest of all was an Enneagram 4.
I'm hilarious.
You're the best, Drew.
No
matter
so
what
sudden.
Alex and Erica say.
This was one of my all-time funnest interviews.
Yes.
When I had the Irish Rovers on the Drew Marshall Show. Do you know they were a bigger deal in Canada than they were anywhere else?
Probably, yeah.
Some of them green alligators and long-necked geese. Some humpty-back camels and some chimpanzees. Some cats and rats and elephants, but sure as you're born, the loveliest of all was an Enneagram 4. All right, I wonder what Gail's doing. Should we just get her on the line? Gail, are you okay? Are you okay?
I'm just sitting here listening to you.
Sorry about that.
What is wrong with us? Are we not? We're so 4, aren't we? Hey?
We won't go into that.
We won't go into that. Ladies and gentlemen.
Not yet.
Joining us on the show is Gail Scott. Gail is a master Enneagram teacher and consultant. She's the founder and director of the Enneagram Mystery School in Boulder, Colorado. And if you want to reach out to Gail, her email address is actually on our website. If you click on today's show, you can read her bio and the address is there. But her address, I'll just tell you now, because I know you're sitting there with a pen in your hand, GailScott@comcast.net. She is that accessible, ladies and gentlemen. Even though she has worked with the Hollywood elite, she will work with you as well. The Enneagram. Thousands of years, spiritual teachers from many different traditions have reminded us of the richness of the human spirit and its potentials, but without real self-knowledge, it's not possible to awaken to the deeper truths of the soul or to sustain whatever degree of realization we have attained. One of the most powerful tools for understanding ourselves and others is the Enneagram, an ancient symbol of unity and diversity, change and transformation. And you want to join us for this 4-part series. Today is part number 3 in July, and explore the personal transformation tool that has helped me more than anything else, the Enneagram. Gail, today, last week, we talked about type 1, type 9, and type 8. Type 1, the reformer, the rational, idealistic type, principled, purposeful, self-controlled, and perfectionistic. You. Type 9, the peacemaker, the easygoing, self-effacing, receptive, reassuring, agreeable, and complacent type. Alex. Type 8, the challenger, the powerful, dominating type, self-confident, decisive, willful, and confrontational. Trump.
Not necessarily.
I knew she was going to say
that.
Yeah,
she always does.
I try to pitch and hold people, and she will let me get away with it every time.
So who's a famous 8?
Who's a famous 8?
Oh, my goodness. I'm not thinking about the 8 headspace right now, but most world leaders.
Hello?
Most world leaders.
Yeah, she just said that.
But also a lot of heads of companies, corporations, a lot of, rough and tumble movie stars, a lot of bosses, leaders.
Right.
Probably a lot of people you know.
No, I don't hang around those people on purpose. because it just makes me too dramatic as a 4. Okay, next week we're going to chat about the investigator, the loyalist, and the enthusiast, but this week it's the helper, the achiever, and the individualist. So we're going to start with number 2,
Well, actually, we're going to start with a little bit of an introduction to the Heart Center.
Because that's right. I'm sorry. I'm an idiot. So last week was the what? The Gut Center? Yeah, the Body
that's
Center?
Right. Last week, we talked about the Belly Center, the Gut Center, types 8, 9, and 1.
Yeah.
And they're all about the instinctual energy, you know, that fullness, vividness, that immediacy, that about being alive. And they're all about, how do I arise in the world? How can I get things done? How do I stay safe? How do I be in control of my life? You know, what boundaries do I have to set up? What do I have to resist? You know, so it's about feeling I'm here in the world, I'm in my body. But now, this week, we're moving to the Heart Center, the feeling triad, and types 2, 3, and 4. And here, we get into an area that is really of utmost tenderness and delicacy and vulnerability, because the energy of the heart, the wounding of the heart, we've all experienced that many, many times in our lives. And it is truly among the most painful things that we can and do experience. And the heart, of course, is the seat of love, but it's also the seat of value and personal identity. Love, of course, being something that everyone wants and needs. We need to be loved. We want to love, and it gives our lives meaning. We also want value, value in the sense of knowing what makes me worthwhile. What is my value in the world? What's my worth? And then identity are questions around, you know, who am I? You know, what's my, you know, why am I here? What is it about? So the heart, the feeling center, is about the important questions of who am I, who is it that's experiencing personhood, why am I here, what's my value, how do I know if I'm of value, what's love, how do I get love. So there's a lot of attention to these, to the hurt that we've experienced around these very tender and narcissistic issues.
Ooh. See, that there's a word that gets thrown around an awful lot these days, and I think it's overused, because clinically, that's a nasty, nasty thing. But sociologically, it just seems to be, you know, tossed around. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about narcissism, that
right.
word.
Yes, of course. We're all narcissistic beings. It becomes a problem when it devolves into narcissistic personality disorders. But narcissism simply means I have a certain self-image. I have a way that I like to be in the world, and I have a way that I like to be seen and appreciated. And I need what are called narcissistic supplies, which means I put it out there who I think I am. I behave in a certain way. I approach people in a certain way. I act a certain way. And I hope and expect that you will receive that in a certain way, that the feedback loop will come back to me, and what I will get, the narcissistic supplies, will be your approval of me, your love, your realization that I'm a worthwhile person, that I have something of value to offer, that I'm someone you want to be around. So there's this sort of garden variety narcissism that every human ego is sort of made of and subject to, and it can be more or less healthy, and it can really go out of whack. But we don't want to make narcissism a nasty word, because every normal, average person deals in it.
I just have to do a little homework here, a little radio stuff here, just a second. Erica, can you please stop and restart the Facebook live streaming? And I need the word Enneagram hashtagged so that people... No, it's not. Gail Scott's hashtag, but not Enneagram. Sorry. We just want people to find us, and hashtagging things is like dropping breadcrumbs, apparently.
Nice.
So we are live on Facebook. Well, we're actually just stopping right now, but we're going to start again with our live Facebook stream on Facebook. Wow. And yes. Joining us is Gail Scott, and Gail has been an Enneagram guru. You're okay with that. Come on, you really are. You really are an Enneagram guru.
Talk about your overused words, but okay.
Yeah, seriously, well said. No, you're right. I mean, Gail discovered the ancient psycho-spiritual Enneagram system in 1989 when I was 4 years old, and began her professional training with world-renowned teachers and authors Don Riso and Russ Hudson. Russ was a guest on the show last year, I believe. Gail,
right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
For the past 10 years, she served as senior faculty of the New York Riso Hudson Enneagram Institute, teaching Enneagram workshops and trainings. And she can be brought up here to Canada, by golly, to do some of that kind of stuff. Master classes and teacher certification courses across North America and around the world. She's also served on the board of directors of the International Enneagram Association from 2000 to 2006, where she chaired the annual Global Enneagram Conference. When Enneagram people get together for one of these little powwows, mm-hmm. Oh, is that like racist too? You can't even say powwow?
Probably not.
Oh, jeez. Anyway, when you guys get together, is it just like a, is it weird?
Is it weird? No, it's quite interesting because it's Enneagram enthusiasts and teachers and authors and researchers from all over the world that come together and share their latest findings and theories, and it's, you know, we get to meet up with each other every year. Yeah.
But do you walk by somebody that you don't like and you know, instead of calling them a name, you go, "Four."
Or instead, hello, my name is.
Hello.
Hello, my number is.
Hello, my number is.
Yeah. Well, I will say that, yes, we do identify each other by our numbers, for better and for worse.
Yes.
There's a lot of talk about numbers. It would probably feel like a different language if you were to eavesdrop in the conference, because we're all speaking Enneagram-ese, yes. But you know what? When you're passionate about the Enneagram, as all of us are that show up there, a lot of times where you live, you don't have a big Enneagram community. So to land in a city and at a conference where everyone is speaking Enneagram all the time, 24/7, it's thrilling.
Well, it is a thrill to have you on, and just before we get into the types, we're going to have to fly through them because I'm rattling on about other things. But I had a conversation with someone yesterday, or the day before, and they said, you know, the issue that I have found with these typing systems is that we tend to, in conversations with others, gravitate towards the negative side of those types instead of emphasizing the positive side. So in other words, when a team go out on one of those team building exercise weekends, mm-hmm. and they take one of these courses, and then all of a sudden they start using the lingo around the office, oh, well, he's like that because he's a four. Oh, no, she's like that because, you know, she's a nine.
And that just shows you how most of us spend most of the day in the average levels of our type, right?
Yes.
Regardless of what type we are. And so we tend to be, you know, gossipy and judgmental and critical, et cetera, because we're just, you know, normal, slouchy folks.
Yes.
The Enneagram, the beauty of the Enneagram, shows us what the entire range of possibility is for our particular type, for each type, and how we can actually, what we call, move up the levels to become a healthier version of our own type. And by healthier, I mean more present, more grounded, more conscientious, more aware, and in particular, less triggered, less hooked by the more negative aspects of
Excellent.
Our personality.
Yes.
You know, less grouchy, less critical.
Sure.
So, as I said, most of us operate in the average levels most of the time.
Yeah.
If we do a lot of inner work and spiritual work, it's certainly very possible to, you know, to move up the levels of our type, and that's what the Enneagram tool is about. That's what it's used for.
Well, I hate admitting this, but I'm a subscriber to Oprah's Super Soul series her podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And I was listening to her and Richard Rohr talk. As a matter of fact, it became our video of the week this week. And eavesdropping in that conversation was some of the best stuff I've heard in a very long time. And it helped. Richard has helped me put words on what I think I believe.
Yes.
And listening to his conversation with Oprah, he said something like, Oprah said, you know, are you like, I don't even know what the question was. It was kind of worded like this. How much of the day are you actually practicing the stuff you preach? And he mm-hmm. said, oh, only a few hours every day, really, if I'm lucky, you know, that kind of a thing. Because the rest of it, you just get caught up in humanity. And
life goes on.
And you're not as intentional. And I love the fact that he admitted that. So anyway, okay, let's get into, which type do you want to go to first? Number two?
Type two, the helper.
All right, number two, the helper, the caring interpersonal type, demonstrative, generous, people-pleasing, and possessive.
All right, so let's start with what it looks like to be a healthy two. The healthy two, so we call this the helper, but sometimes male twos like to be called the mentor, and we use that in business. That seems to work. They're also called the giver, the caretaker, the altruist, the lover, the pleaser. But a healthy two is really the embodiment of what the good mother or the good parent is supposed to be, you know, really warm, loving, generous, helpful, considerate, compassionate, really tuned in to the other person. When you're in the presence of a healthy two, you feel that you matter to the two. And healthy twos will go out of their way for you. You know, they're the person you turn to when you're sick or in need or, you know, need help or advice. They're extremely loving and empathetic. And their purpose in the world, really, like the soul of the two comes from a place where they remember where the universe was nothing but, you know, divine love and lovingness, and love was everywhere, and I am loved, and I am a source of love. And when that, what we call the primal catastrophe, happens, and that break happens from our divine essence, and we're, you know, tossed out of the garden, it feels to the two like all the love in the universe has disappeared. There is no love. There is no divine love. There is no love in me. And so the ego of the two gets very busy, very quickly, trying to reestablish that love. And how I'm going to go about doing that is by being the loving person. I am going to be the source of love in the world, and in particular, in the world of people I, you know, who are important to me, who I most care about. So it's like my cup runneth over with love. I'm empathetic. Healthy twos also have this lovely sort of free-spirited quality. They tend to be very positive and joyous. And when they're healthy, they're happy to give, and they're not looking for anything in return. Like there's no, you know, strings attached, and they're very sincere. So there's this sense of loving, listening, you know, and it's very heartfelt, and people sort of warm up, they shine, you know, people are drawn to them, and healthy twos warm you in this sort of loving glow of their hearts, and they really enliven others with a kind of genuine appreciation and caring attention that they give to other people. So they're there for you, you know, they're generous, but importantly, a healthy two also knows how to receive, right? Down the levels of health, twos have a hard time receiving because their focus is completely on other people all the time.
Okay, this sounds like, I can't even believe I'm asking this question. Could you tip that up a bit as well? We're getting Gord Traynor giving us some directing here on the Facebook Live. Yeah, just to tip it up a little bit. It's a little higher. It sounds like the helper number two. Well, let me ask you, what Enneagram type do you think Jesus was?
Okay, so he was not a type. In the Enneagram symbol, it's a large circle which represents the oneness, the all, and then there's nine types around the circle. Jesus is represented by the circle itself and also the center of the circle, which is the combination of all of the types. So we don't ascribe a personality type to Jesus and to the historical Jesus, but we say it's the same thing in the Jewish Kabbalah, right? In the Tree of Life, there are 10 spheros, and nine of them relate and are representative of the nine personality types, but the one at the top, which is called Keter, is the spot, the parking spot reserved for the Savior, for the Redeemer.
You know, so, I think that's just Enneagram people copping out and not, because doesn't everybody fit into a type? Everybody does, and he was human as well as God, so he must have a type. Or is that just you guys staying away from pigeonholing Jesus?
Well, I don't think that's a good idea, but it really is, the Enneagram is symbolic of something, and Christ consciousness could not be limited to one type, because it means that you would be excluding so many gifts, attributes, you know, of the other eight. So it doesn't really work.
Tim?
Would that apply to all sort of the religious leaders, like a Buddha or a, you know, Muhammad?
Not exactly, because they're in a different category. They were mortals and who awakened. So Buddha, for instance, it seems clear from everything we know about him that he was a type 5, and Buddhism itself is a very intellectual type 5 religion, and what what Buddha went through to achieve enlightenment was a very 5-ish path.
Okay.
All right. How would someone recognize an unhealthy helper? Because the helper, I'm sorry, I keep going to this, but man, as a 4, like I read my description as a 4 and I roll my eyes and go, ugh, give me a break. And when I read the description of a helper, I go, yeah, that's what I want to be.
That's what you want to be?
Yes.
Okay. Well,
maybe not people-pleasing and possessive.
Yeah.
You know, but I do want to be more helpy. Helpy?
Well, sure, and you can be. But, you know, it's not an easier road for the two than for the four, really, for any type. It's very much dependent on how healthy you are in your own type. If we're healthy in our type, things are flowy and easy and fun, and life is beautiful and wonderful, and we feel connected to our own goodness and divinity. When we're down in the average levels, we have average problems. When we're down, you know, when we're healthy, unhealthy, we all, you know, suffer extremely. But so for the two, I would say twos are the most people and relationship oriented. I think it's important to understand that. So what's important to the two is to be able to feel that I have love, that I'm a source of love in the world and in your life. So I'm looking for love through interpersonal connection. Now, this sets up a lot of issues. I feel that my ego personality feels that I need to be attentive and nice and supportive and be there for other people. Now, I have this genuine impulse to do that, but it gets distorted by the ego, and it becomes really central to my self-image. So I feel that I have to seduce people by giving them attention and appreciation.
Right.
Now, as a four, I think that would not be...
No, that's inauthentic.
...do that, right?
It's inauthentic, yeah.
It would feel inauthentic, exactly. But for the two, this feels like this is the imprimatur, this is what I've got to do. So I use my energy going out to put my attention on other people. And then my hope, my dear hope is that by nurturing and supporting and taking care of your needs, I will win your love, your approval, your attention, your validation. Yeah. So I try to get people to like me and prove that I'm lovable. In response to particularly my service and my kindnesses. And under that, there is this sort of needy little question of that I'm asking is, do you see what I'm doing for you? Do you see how much I'm sacrificing? Do you see how much I'm improving your life?
Oh, no, I don't want to be a two anymore.
Do you see what a good person I am? As a four, that's not for you.
No, that's got. I got it. Okay, all right. Okay, let's talk about the achiever. Now, listen, we've got a young lady in our studio, another intern. Last week, we talked about Alex, the intern, and her personality type, known as the peacemaker. Well, Erica, the intern, did the Enneagram test, or the quiz, or whatever it's called, at the Enneagram Institute website, Enneagram Institute, and she came out with Achiever. And Erica, what was the thing that I said to you when I said Achiever? You're an Achiever? What did I say to you, Erica?
It's not possible.
It's not possible.
I think it was a compliment, though. I don't know.
Well, and I have to admit this publicly. This is not cool, but this is what you don't do with this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But you're going to do it anyway?
Yes. No, I'm admitting this is what you don't do. This is a prime example of what you don't do. I know someone who's a three,
mm-hmm.
and the parts of that person who's a three I don't like.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've kind of put all the – because that was the first three I ever really, you know
– Figured out.
Figured out. You know, they did the test, and it was the three and everything. I was like, ugh, I really don't like that part and that part and that part and that part.
Mm-hmm.
And so now when I come across threes, I go, ugh.
Well, I'm going to just go out on a limb here and take a guess that if you really thought about it for about a minute and a half, there are people of every type that you don't like.
Well, probably, but this one was the worstest.
Okay, so let's talk about the healthy three, the achiever, that we call the three, the motivator, the paragon. And by the way, someone that you just mentioned, I think, is a healthy three, and that's Oprah. The status seeker, the role model, the success-oriented, efficient type. Now,
I don't like Oprah either. Sorry, go ahead.
We call the three the achiever. Why? Because they come into this world programmed by temperament. Personality is temperament. Programmed by temperament to become highly motivated to achieve personal success in their life. And also because their sense of their own value comes from their sense of personal achievement. So on, you know, the positive, threes tend to exemplify everyone's desire to be our best self, you know, to achieve our personal best, to work hard, to develop our potentials. And threes are generally quite hardworking. They're ambitious. They're competent, they're organized, they're focused, they're in it for the long haul, they're goal-oriented. And they're often, not always, but often quite charming and diplomatic. They, a lot of times, work in sales, and they can make very good salespeople. they also tend to be like ambitious overachievers, and we all knew these people in the threes in high school who they often rise to the top early. You know, they become class president or the team captains or the head cheerleader or something.
I hate them all. I hate them all.
The homecoming king. Well, you know, that's not actually surprising because there are some the type 3 personality and the type 4 personality are sort of at odds in a lot of ways. And so I will just tell you that the threes probably feel the same way about you.
Yes. Thank you. A lot of personality. No, because whenever I watch those high school movies, by the way, I love watching high school movies.
Oh, really?
And I think I figured this out because the victim component of being a four,
mm-hmm.
the arc, the story arc of those high school movies usually has something to do with the poor schmuck. The victim, yep. right? The person, kid who gets picked on or whatever,
right.
and then they get their own. They get a revenge and they
right.
you
know,
but,
revenge of the nerds.
Sure, you know that okay. kind of thing. And then who are the jerks in the movie?
Threes.
The class. The threes.
Yeah.
Yes,
Erica.
Yes. So it's true. Every type. It's very easy to make fun of every type, and it makes for great drama. So yes, a lot of times the people to whom success seems to come easy, although they're working really hard at it. You know, people become jealous of that. Later in life, especially, you know, in our culture, these overachieving threes tend to become really high-powered entrepreneurs or real estate mavens or ad execs or Wall Street traders, supermodels, a lot of professional athletes. They also like to become coaches and motivators or doctors, lawyers, directors, movie stars. They tend to be actually the stars of the personality type
okay.
and of human nature
this
who
is, sorry.
Embody what it means to be the best in many areas of a culture. Yep. And to their credit, they're very often, you know, self-made men and women who, by golly, are able to overcome all kinds of difficult childhoods and destitute backgrounds. They're all for, you know, pulling myself up by the bootstraps. I'm going to work hard. I'm going to achieve something in this life, you know, and other people are able to see their hopes and their dreams mirrored in these people. And that's certainly, you know, true for Oprah. But so it's about becoming someone of value, about developing myself and being who I want to be in order to be valuable and worthwhile.
Okay. The reason I kind of wigged out when Erica did the thing, the test. It's not a test. What's the right word? What's the word called?
Yeah, it's a test.
Okay. Wow. when Erica did the Enneagram test and came out as an achiever.
Yes.
I didn't agree with it because, well, number one, I like Erica.
Thank you.
Number two, I don't see her as, you know, needing to be, have the limelight on her or wanting to be some, hey, everybody, I'm successful and I'm, you know, look at me kind of whatever.
So again, you're talking about traits that are in the average to lower average, you know, areas of
yeah,
this type.
Yeah.
And
so she's a healthy three.
A few minutes ago, you started talking about how everybody, you know, goes away and starts talking about the, you know, the lower average aspect of time. That's what you're doing about the three. It's like, I think you either have not been exposed to or don't have, you know, close relationships with healthy threes. And so you have like the typical, you know, stereotypical image
yeah.
of the fixated three who is extremely, you know, grandiose and narcissistic and look at me and I want the center of attention and, you know, it means like having lots of money and fame and
yeah,
notoriety
yeah.
and the big house and the fancy car and all this
stuff. But they're not really good otherers. And I don't, yeah, they're not otherers.
What? They're not what?
It's not a real word. I've made it up, but I use it a lot, so please use it.
What is it?
Otherers. They don't, they're not good. They're not like a helper.
Well, because they're not a helper. They're an achiever.
Oh.
You know, where they do help people in their own three-ish way is by motivating and inspiring other people to be the best that they can be. And sometimes they do that, you know, just by becoming role models, and that's a really important function that they play in our society that, you know, kids can look up to and go, oh, my God, if he or she could do that,
yeah.
you know, I'll work hard and I can do it. But what's important to threes is to develop themselves. And now, they might want to have the money and fame or whatever, but, you know, it can also mean being, you know, if you live in a cattle town, being a successful vet or, you know, here in Boulder, being, you know, the top, you know, bicycle tech genius or, you know, also being a successful politician or a highly regarded minister, you know.
Right.
They mostly want to be someone who's noteworthy in their family and community, preferably, you know, the best. And what drives that is this very deep interpretation when they come into the world, that you will only admire me and love me because I embody some admirable qualities. What I do, my accomplishments, and, you know, that's what's important. Threes get the idea at a very, very young age, and this is a much longer, you know, backstory of how this all comes into structure, but threes interpret how they are treated in their family of origin. They interpret it as this message: I am not loved for who I am. I'm loved for what I do.
Yeah.
So that becomes like the basic truth upon which they build the building blocks of their personality. Therefore, they start to feel that who I am isn't really seen or appreciated. It doesn't matter. But by golly, when I do something, like even as a baby, you know, it's like when I take those first few steps and, like, you know, walk across the room between mommy and daddy, oh my God, the place lights up. Yeah. Everybody loves that. And I get a big applause for that. And the little ego of that little soul goes, whoa, that felt good. I get it now. I have to do something, and then everybody will love me and smile and hug me, and, you know. And so that carries on throughout the rest of their life.
Okay, I think we just struck a chord with Erica. I just saw her face light up a little bit. So, Erica, yeah, how are you feeling about this? Because I said at the beginning, when you did the Enneagram test and you came out as an achiever, I said, well, some people, when they do the Enneagram test, they do it like – they answer the questions based on who they think they should be or who they want to be rather than who they are. And I wondered if that was you.
No.
So it's not you.
No, this is me. This
Nailed
is
it.
Very accurate.
Really?
Everything.
You have just schooled me something fierce. Yeah. Wow. So what are you resonating the most with?
All of it, honestly. It's just kind of shocking to hear someone describe me so accurately. And even, like, we want to be successful, and I find that it's bad, but when other people aren't, and when people aren't trying, it really bothers me.
Yes.
And the whole, I'm not loved for who I am, but for what I do, it almost makes me competitive, because if I'm doing more, like, I have one sister, and if I got an A and she got a B, well, I want to be loved more. I got the A.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is bad, but it's true, and I guess that's where that comes from. Like, I never really knew why, because my family's very loving. It's just they love you. They love me for who I am. It's just do what you want. But I'm not like that.
Right, right. So even though your family loves you for who you are, you actually don't believe it until they can love you for what you did?
I believe it, but I don't think they should, which is... I know it's bad.
It's really a matter for all of us of our worldview that gets set up. So, like, you can have two or three or four, you know, siblings in the same family, but having the, you know, very similar experiences. But what we are able to take in from our parents is screened, is filtered by our temperament, by our personality. So they might be sending out all kinds of signals and doing all kinds of behaviors toward us, but because this is set in place, you know, in infancy, if not in utero, we're only working with 1/9 of the pie. And we can only take in and interpret what is meaningful to our ego in order to start building up the structures of our ego.
So good.
So it's not about what your parents really, what they did or didn't do. It's about how your ego structures reach out and pull in certain messages and then chew on that to create the ego structures and to create the personality.
I'm glad I admitted what a moron I am, because this is a life lesson for everybody when it comes to typing, and our biases. It's like, you know, when you have a kid and you go to name your kid, you don't name your kid the name of your school bully. Why? Because there's an association there, right? You're not going to – you understand that concept, right?
As a teacher, yeah. There's a million names that I would never have named my children, because all they did was brought up bad memories, right?
Of other kids you've taught who were morons or whatever, yeah.
Maroon.
I don't forget what my point was there.
It's a good one, though.
Oh, yeah.
What a jerk you were.
Well, thanks for remembering that, Gail. Thank you. But I was kind of going off of my own personal experience with a particular three that was just sort of stuck in my brain. Mm-hmm. And I just compared you and that person. Not cool. No. Not cool at all.
But understandable.
Yeah, just not cool, though.
And we all do that. I mean, we're very prone to stereotyping people. That's one of the real, I think, beauties and value of spending time with and going deeper into the Enneagram system as we start to understand in a very deep way how these structures get set up in us. It's not like anybody, you know, just decides one day, well, I think I'll be just, you know, a total jerk and alienate people for the rest of my life. No, everything that we
What's wrong with that?
Everything that we do is learned from an early age when we're trying to construct this ego structure, this personality. We have to become someone. Ego is really just an enormous, elaborate set of defense mechanisms, right? It's how we protect ourselves as little kids and how we get through, you know, the terribly dangerous waters of early childhood and early life. So we create these structures, but then, you know, usually if we're doing personal work and being introspective, when we get to a certain age, we start to realize, you know, this doesn't feel real and authentic to me anymore. I feel like I'm just relying on some kind of structure that isn't really me.
Okay, just before we get Erica to ask you some questions, I want to just ask you two questions myself, and we've asked you this before, but it comes up every time I talk about this, the Enneagram, with someone. Are you born a type and stay that type your whole life, or do you change? Because I did hear, I think somewhere along the line, someone said to me, well, you don't, and this might be two separate questions, probably is, you don't really know. It's rare for someone under, you know, lower than their 20s to kind of have a clear understanding of what type they are.
Oh, I disagree with that entirely. Okay. I've been around many children, children in my own life, and also the children of friends of mine and other Enneagram people and teachers. I have been able to identify a child's type with pretty good certainty by, you know, age of two or three.
What?
And then you just kind of wait to see it fill in. No, this is...
Yeah, but you're a guru.
All right, but even as I think I mentioned last time, like a mother who's had a child, has had more than one child, knows that they have a different energy and really a different personality, even in utero and when they come out. So it starts, we're not sure exactly when it starts, but probably sometime in utero, maybe at conception, maybe after that. But it is womb to tomb. You come out, you're born with a particular temperament, and scientists actually know now that there are 9 temperaments that one can be born with. So you get 1 through 9, and you are that type, we call it the dominant type, throughout your life until you die. However, within that structure, you cannot change types, you can't jump from one to another, but within your dominant type, there is like a limitless capacity to develop and expand and grow and become healthier and actually to, you know, become a saint, you know, within your type. So there's a lot of room to stretch and move and get better or get worse, but we don't change types.
Okay.
Absolutely not.
Okay. I just figured out that Erica is a 9 because I'm looking down at the sheets in front of her, and she printed off the entire assessment that she got after doing the Enneagram test. It's printed, stapled, highlighted. I get it now. I get it. I was wrong. Oh, my goodness.
So he told me to read it.
You are an achiever. Okay, questions for Gail, Erica.
Okay, so my first question would be, for a lot of threes, and well, I guess for me, I find that if I feel like I'm in a position where I could fail, I find that I get very distant from people. I become very isolated. Mm. I get really moody, very stressed.
Wow, you are a 3.
I am a 3.
Yeah.
And I know that this causes a lot of problems for people, especially because a lot of the people around me are 2s and 9s and all these nice open people. So they all want to know what I'm feeling, and the last thing I want them to know is how I'm feeling.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So how does a 3 address that?
Great question.
And how do they work with people that aren't necessarily like that to let them know that they love them and that it's not personal and that we don't share because we really don't want to, not because we don't trust them? Because I find that that's a big problem with a lot of people, is they think that I don't trust them, but I just really don't want them to know if I think I'm going to fail.
Ah, okay. So it's about failure. Yes. For the type 3 achiever, failure is the F word. It is the single thing that holds the most terror, because if I'm a failure, obviously I'm not achieving, and if I have any kind of failure in my life, it means I'm worthless, I have no value, and for the ego, that that's ego death, right? So it's very important for threes to maintain a sense of achieving. Now, of course, the growth path here, the spiritual path, is to come to the realization that your outer achievements are not really what is going to do it for you in the end, because those things come and go, and there is failure, etc. But because threes are so tend to be so outward and achievement-oriented, a lot of times what suffers is the attention to my inner life, to developing, you know, my inner character, to knowing who I am and what really makes me happy. Because I'm a doer and achiever and I'm focusing on functioning because I think that's how I'm going to get love and validation, know I'm worthwhile, there can be often, it's not really a decision, but threes will sort of sacrifice or dissociate from feelings in order to be better at what they do. A type 3 client once said to me, feelings are like speed bumps on my path to success. When I'm functioning at top form, I can't afford to have feelings.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't allow my feelings to get in the way. And when I'm all involved in my feelings, I cannot function at my best. And so my ego believes that it's the functioner who will be loved. So that's where I'm putting all of my attention.
Look at your face. You are
so
lighting
accurate.
Up. All right, another question. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so one of the things I always suggest to my three clients is it's kind of a meditation, and it's something that you can do repeatedly when you're sitting quietly with yourself. Well, two things. One is to do something good anonymously that no one will know about.
So and good that, for three.
That you won't get any applause or validation from, and see how that feels to you. And the other is to ask yourself, what is my true heart's desire? Like, if achievement and success and money and all of it, you know, didn't matter, what would I do with my life? What gives me the most satisfaction and pleasure and thrill and joy in my life? And it doesn't have to be anything that has, you know, material rewards. But a lot of times we see that threes become, because they're trying to be loved by the parents and everything, they will do whatever is, you know, gets the best, you know, payback. And they lose touch with the inner workings of their heart. They lose touch with their heart's desire. And, you know, they become a dentist because everybody in the family was a dentist or whatever. So it can be very, very healing and valuable for a three to really, you know, sit with herself and say, what is my heart's desire? What would I really like to be doing with my life in this moment? And then do it.
Wow. Okay.
Thank you.
You're gold. You are just gold. Anything else right now, Erica? Or are we okay?
Am I allowed to talk a bit about...
No.
Okay, I'm going to do it anyway. My top three, I got Achiever, Challenger, and Reformer. And I was just wondering, because when I was reading through them, they all seem to me anyway, like they have kind of the same goals. They all want to be successful. They all want to get things done. But what differentiates the Achiever in their approach to things and their way of doing things from these other two types?
Motivation. It's always about motivation. When we're talking about, when we're trying to distinguish, differentiate between different types, it's not what we do, it's why we do it. So if you look at those three types, so you said the Reformer type one. Reformer type ones are not trying to achieve in order to have a sense of achievement about myself. They're in service of achieving, achieving is not even the right word. They're in service to doing the right thing for the higher good, for the greater good. So it's a very different motivation. Even when it's, you know, selfish, it's in the end, it's not really about how I'm going to be perceived as being successful or having achieved. It's like, my superego is driving me to, at all times, do the right thing regardless. And if there's any kind of achieving involved, it's about being a good person. So very different motivation.
Wow. Oh, your top three again are what?
Achiever.
Achiever's number one.
Challenger's number two.
Yep.
And then Reformer.
And the Reformer type
Man,
one.
Man, see, that's it. All three of those. Oh, this is me being an idiot again, Gail, so to rein me in. But all three of those in their unhealthier states, I'm learning, have sort of an abrasive shtick to them.
They do.
And you are just so freaking nice and amicable.
Maybe she's
the
healthy.
The environment.
That's what I'm saying.
Too.
Oh. What do you mean?
I don't need to be dominating and aggressive in this environment. I think that I adapt to where I am. So I come in here on day one and I just don't get that feeling from it. So I want to achieve. I want to do my best job.
Right.
I want to make sure that everybody else is satisfied too, because I want everyone else to achieve. So to me, I don't have to come in and be dominating and aggressive and rude to do that.
Are you dominating and aggressive at times?
I can be.
Really?
Very competitive. Mm-hmm. I want the best results, and if it upsets people, then I get there. That's okay.
Wow. Were you a competitive achiever in school?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Brutally.
Brutally?
Yes.
Brutally.
Okay. So you'd be a great study partner.
Unless you wanted a break. I don't like that.
Yeah, unless you want to slough around and, you know, yeah. I don't know, watch I Love Lucy instead.
Yeah, no.
What? How old am I? Watch I Love Lucy.
Survivor is even outdated.
Sorry.
I need the name of that book.
Oh,
before we go any farther.
Gail, what's the name of the Riso Hudson book that I've been devouring?
It's called The Wisdom of the Enneagram.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would say by far it has been the most exhaustive book that I've seen out there. And when I use the word exhaustive, I mean that in the nicest way.
You mean it exhausted you to read it?
No, it's so good. I mean, it's just, obviously, everyone goes to their own chapter first.
Yes, this is fine. Yes.
What's the name of the author?
Hudson and Riso, two different
Riso?
Guys. Riso and Hudson.
R-I-S-O, Don Riso and Seth Hudson.
Okay, let's stop asking questions. It's time to talk about us.
Okay, but I want to know more about me because that's what I am.
So the individualists, type 4, the sensitive, withdrawn type, expressive, dramatic, self-absorbed, and temperamental. None of those sound awesome. None.
Expressive doesn't sound
awesome. Well, okay, expressive, but oh, man.
Well, actually, you know what? The 4s, type 4s, are one of the wannabe types. People want to be 4s.
What?
And, yes, and they often even mistakenly identify themselves as 4s because they identify with and they like the idea of being creative and romantic, and that's what 4s are known for. Don Riso, as a matter of fact, one of the authors who is a type 4 himself, I love what he said one time. He said the 4s are the deep-sea divers of the unconscious, and they're not necessarily artists, but what's true, I would say, about all 4s is that they have a kind of poetic and artistic temperament that sets them apart. They're very sensitive creatures. They're like their filters are wide open and they're taking everything in, and they have a highly developed aesthetic sense, whether they're actually artists or not. They love and appreciate beauty. Beauty, depth, and meaning. That's what it's all about for the 4s. And so you'll see that even their clothing, their homes, their workspaces will always be tasteful and personal. It doesn't matter what their particular style is, but they put thought into it. And if they have artistic talent, they might be able to create, you know, beautiful personal art. Could be anything, you know, music, poetry, literature, visual arts, you know, anything. But what's particular about their art, what they create, is that it's generally autobiographical. So as these deep sea divers of the unconscious, 4s are fearless in a certain way, meaning that they're not afraid to dive deep into the dark depths of their own experience and bring up, like deal with and look at and turn it around and bring up the immense pain and suffering and longing in their lives, and perhaps write or sing about it, you know, in ways that other people can relate to. So their personal experience taps into the universal experience of us all. And that is why most of the greatest, I would say, troubadours and poets and singer-songwriters, the people who bring us that deep, mushy, sometimes, you know, painful, emotional experience, they're always 4s. In Canada, for instance, you know, some of my favorite 4 singer-songwriters, Leonard Cohen, for one, Joni Mitchell, you know, Neil Young, Bob Dylan, Alanis Morissette, like, these are the deep-sea divers who are not afraid to talk about the underbelly, the shadow material, the yucky stuff, the painful stuff, and bring it up, and actually how they see redemption is by turning it into something beautiful.
However, with that deep sea diving, you got to learn to take a breath every once in a while, because if you're hanging around a three, an achiever, or you're hanging around a nine, peacemaker, they don't want to go there all the time.
Well, they certainly don't. Nobody wants to go where other types go all the time.
Oh, that's true.
That's one of the reasons that fours often hang out with other fours, because, like, all right, we're not going to be superficial. You know, we're going to dive deep. We're going to talk about what's real and meaningful and, you know, maybe ugly. But the fours are sort of, in a way, sort of addicted to a kind of emotional intensity. Like, they just, you know, love the sludgy stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, some people can go along with that and some not. Fours in general don't consider themselves like nice people or sweet people.
Nope.
But what they do is that they will give you an experience of depth and meaning and, you know,
yep,
what's real in this world. Authenticity is very important to type fours.
Yeah. My brain went six different places there, and I came up with nothing. I have an absolute gap happening right now. Tim?
Happens
well,
all the time.
I can just keep talking. One of the things that really identifies the four, they reveal how, well, for most of us, but particularly fours, our identity is mostly derived from our interpretation of our history, right? And we think that our interpretation is, you know, objective, how it really was. But, of course, you know, two or more people can be in the same experience at the same time and have completely different interpretations. And usually we don't interpret our past or our childhood as a comedy. But the four takes her or his identity from all that painful, yucky, negative stuff that they perceive or interpreted has been done to them. And
Victim,
yeah. And they love to share, especially with significant others, you know, all the gory details of their awful childhood, you know, how mistreated, how ignored, how misunderstood, how abused I was, you know, first by my family of origin, you know, then by my lovers, my ex-spouses, you know, whomever. And the passion of the four is envy, and they tend to think that everybody else got all the goodies that they needed, but just not me. Like, nobody else was as, you know, wounded as I was. I'm the one who got shortchanged. And the big delusion, ego delusion, and all of this is, of course, that, you know, I'm the only one this happened to, and therefore I'm entitled to special treatment because I've suffered more than everyone else, or I'm more sensitive than you, and, you know, you can't possibly feel the suffering like I do. My problems are much deeper than yours, and I'm inherently more damaged, more flawed than anyone else. And everybody out there is having, like, a good time, dancing around, falling in love, you know, and here I am, alone, you know, crying under the covers, misunderstood.
Shut up!
Anything there for you?
Nope, I don't get any of that at all whatsoever.
None of that rings.
None. It just sounds pathetic.
Well, this is the fixated part of it. So
the unhealthy part, right?
We have all this, you know, pathetic, you know, we all have pathetic parts to it. Another important thing about the four, if anyone's wondering if they're a four, is that they form their identity from very strong feelings that they're unique and different, especially from their family of origin. But there's a sense of specialness and uniqueness, feeling special and different, but at the same time feeling, you know, misunderstood.
See, I uber relate to that from the point of view of, well, I was known as the village idiot no matter what group I was in.
Oh,
school, my peers, or camp, I was the goofball, right? And contrast that with growing up in a funeral home family who they've got to be, like, they're so straight, they're stiff. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Inside joke.
But
then now throw in the whole, and I was adopted.
Yep.
Holy cow.
Okay, well, that plays right into the four fixation because fours, as I just mentioned, feel very different from their family of origin. And a lot of fours, whether they're actually adopted or whether there's like a video of them coming out of their mother's body, will feel that, I say that because my type 4 goddaughter is here and I happen to have a video that I taped her birth. But anyway.
Introducing.
They feel so different from the family of origin that they often think that they were left on the wrong doorstep, or they were switched at the hospital, or, you know, they're somehow were left with the wrong family. And it does not actually matter how, you know, kind and attuned and loving that family is to the type 4.
Exactly.
It is just a given that in within each of our temperaments, certain things are going to deform, are going to form in us. Sometimes I feel deformed.
Freudian.
A Freudian slip, yeah. They're going to form, and then we're going to create our identity on you know, on the basis of that. So fours get their ego identity from feelings of being unique and individual, and they're looking to be, you know, to be mirrored. I feel like there's as a four that there's some magical ingredient, you know, necessary to be completely successful and human, and I didn't get it. It's like, you know, I'm trying to get it together. I'm trying to show up and be functional, but I just can't concoct anything that feels convincing to me or would be to other. So what does the four do? She has to fall back on some way of knowing herself, and he or she becomes very self-conscious, very aware of what her feelings, right? So for the four, it's all about how am I feeling? And, of course, there are problems with that because our feelings are not constant. You know, they're ever-changing. So if who I am is my feelings and my feelings are ever-changing, then who I am is ever-changing. And that means my identity will be shifting and will seem unreliable.
But you you balance give and take. The reason that fours can look introspective and have those Joni Mitchell songs, I mean, that's the great thing about it. But I guess the negative thing about it is because you're constantly struggling with your feelings.
That's right. And constantly asking the question, who am I?
Yeah.
You know, what is the meaning of my life? Who am I really? Who am I really? So, and it feels like there's no rock solid, you know, bottom core because my emotional states are all over the place, you know, and what can I count on? I don't know from moment to moment how I'm going to feel. And you know, threes do it through accomplishment being valued, but they, twos and threes both tend to stay away from all those negative feelings. But the four sort of makes a career out of rolling around in all the yucky stuff that other people are trying to get out of, right?
Oh, really? We make a career out of talking about this sort of thing?
Pigs in mud.
See, here's the deal. Like, what really gets under my skin is when someone accuses me of this whole, the Drew Marshall Show is, or Drew Marshall is all about, you know, oh, he's not sure who he is spiritually, and he's not sure. And it's a shtick. It's just, oh, it's a way to get listeners. Oh, shut up. It's not a way to get listeners. This is genuine, bona fide mental hell, emotional hell.
Right. Not only that, it's actually your deepest egoic drive. The drive of the four is to figure out my place in things, and particularly, very often, my spirit. What's the authentic spiritual universe in which I live. So, yes, asking those questions, you know, who am I? Who is God? What is my relationship to God? Am I relevant? Does God even know who I am? Did he look down and, you know, see some kind of generic little speck of dust? Or, you know, so fours are always trying to be unique and shine in a certain way. And partly the underlying, you know, motivation is to be seen by God. But it all comes back to beauty. I have a sign on my office because I relate to a lot of the fourness that says, you know, beauty will save the world. And I think most fours, you know, believe that. And what is salve for the four when they're down and depressed, and fours are the most prone type to get into depression because they're down there messing around with all that, you know, deep, dark, shadowy, ugly stuff. And by the way, there's a kind of an addiction that fours have to negative emotions and to the yucky stuff. Why? Because that feels good to their ego. It feels like, you know, if I were just, you know, going to slap a happy face on me and have superficial conversations with people, blah, 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 you know, I'd kill myself, you know, because that's not a meaningful life. No, I want to get down deep and figure out, you know, what's real and authentic, and I want to be that authentic person. And that means dealing with and actually identifying with a lot of strong negative emotions. When people are trying to figure out if they're a four or not, one of the questions I always throw out is, how do you feel about hatred?
I don't like it.
Most fours will go, yeah, I get it. You know, I hated my mother. I hate this person. I hate that person. You know, I hope to die. It's like, you know, that's just...
Oh, that's an unhealthy four, though.
It's any four.
What if we hate a really bad person? Is that okay?
My issue is hating myself.
Right. There's a lot of... So the underlying feeling, the what I call the river that runs through it for the 2, 3, and 4 is shame.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So for the 8, 9, and 1, it was anger and rage. But for the 2, 3, and 4, it's shame. So there are different versions of, you know, what that shame is about. But the 4 feels shame around, there is a sense that I didn't get the manual when I was born. I don't quite know how to live. It's sort of an ordinary, successful life. I don't know how to relate without getting all triggered by things and, you know, going into the negativity and, you know, all of that. It's life can be very difficult.
The three of us, Erica and Tim and I, all being in this category, are high-fiving the snot out of each other here in the studio.
High-fouring.
High-fouring. Get it? Oh, this is so good. Oh, I love this. Love this. Oh, okay, we have to stop.
Yeah. So just to say, there's no such thing as an always extroverted, totally optimistic 4. That's a 7. But if you cannot hang out with deep, dark feelings like envy, disgust, hatred, you're probably, you know, not a 4. And it's temperament. You know, for the 4, life can be just going along fine, but, you know, the average 4 can still feel dark and moody much of the times. And they do tend to have, you know, their moods shift rapidly. And, you know, they might be like, wait a minute, I can't be having fun here. My life is tragic. I'm a suffering artist. No one understands me. You know, it's like, wipe that smile off your face. You know?
Oh, man. You
and
are
I will
great.
Say, in terms of the transformation, it is difficult but transformative. When a 4, not naming names, but when a 4 finally realizes that there is probably absolutely nothing more fundamentally wrong with me than anyone
else. Not naming any names.
Not, you know, and just kind of get over it, look for the beauty, you know, and
stop playing the bloody victim all the time.
Yeah.
Gee, not naming any names. Gail, I would like to name your name. I can say this now because we've known each other long enough and it helps that we've never met. I love you. Thank you.
Thank you.
No, thank you. You are offering good stuff to the world. You know, when people say, what mark have I left on the world? Oh, Gail, you have left your mark all over the... That just made you sound like a dog.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean.
I've been marking my territory.
Yes. Helping the fire hydrants of the world.
Thank you for everything. And ladies and gentlemen, you need to creep on this girl and... By the way, come out with a book already, will you? Gee whiz.
Oh, I've got a couple in the works, but boy, it's a lot of time.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, she has gotten up my grill probably more than most people. Drew, write the book already.
That's right.
So you can reach Gail directly at Gail Scott, 2 T's. Gail Scott, the T's are in Scott,
Gail.
Not Gail. What?
You better spell Gail.
Oh, yeah, that's right. GAYLESCOTT at Comcast.net. And if you don't have time.
By the way, I have received some very nice letters from your listeners, and that's very sweet. I like that.
Letters?
Mm-hmm. You know, emails.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
I was going to say, how old are our listeners? They didn't have enough spit to seal the envelope, but they got it to you. Thank you again, Gail. And we'll talk to you next week for our final week, our final live show of our season 16. And next week, we're going to chat about the investigator, the loyalist, and the enthusiast, the last three types. Thank you. Thank you. Right. Thank you, Gail.
See you then.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Gail Scott on the Drew Marshall Show. I just love this stuff. Love this stuff.